This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And the conversation continues this morning, yes, about the NDIS. Why not? Because this is a big complex change to a big complex system that's going to affect so many of us. So this is your chance. Call us. I would like to know your comments, but also your questions. What are your questions? What have you been thinking about since that announcement from the federal government almost 24 hours ago? Huge changes, but not a lot of granular detail. So we're all still absorbing the news. So this morning on the Conversation Hour, if you have a question, we have an expert to help you. Jump on the lines now, 1300 222 774. Of course, she won't be able to give you personalised advice, but she knows the system. She's looked at the announcements and she can explain to us the changes. As I say, some of those are so complex, and maybe she can tell you what we know and what we still don't know. She might be able to ease our worries or sharpen our thinking or reveal some nuance that we might just not have seen. Or also tell me your stories. Tell me about your worries, what you've been thinking about for the past day. Also today, how young were you when you started to play sport? You know, the sport that might have brought you much success. Most people say, well, in their teenage years, maybe as a young child. Maybe. Were you a toddler? 1300 222 774. How old were you when you started playing your sport? I'm going to talk to a mum whose kid became obsessed with golf at the age of two. Yes, two. He wouldn't be taking home stuffed toys. He wouldn't be taking those off to daycare. He'd take golf balls. He'd sleep with golf balls. This kid at the ripe old age of six is going to Canada to play in a tournament. What do you do if you have a kid that precocious? Have you had a kid like that? Were you a kid like that? Tell me when you started playing sport. When is young too young? I want to hear all about what this mum is facing in her life, the judgment, but also this sweet kid who just wants to play golf. Christine, you've called in from Ivanhoe. You want to talk about the NDIS?
Yes, I have. Yeah. I've got a couple of points to make. One is that the minister is really only talking about the original intent of the NDIS. It was about people who functionally had, well, disabled in their daily lives. It had little to do with diagnoses. So he's just going back to the original.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is, my concern is around the training of the people who will do the assessments.
Indeed.
I'll give you perhaps an example. If someone is asked, do they shower independently or do they shower? I have clients who, yes, can have the individual skills for showering, but they can't string them together.
Right. And in what capacity do you work with these clients, Christine?
As a psychologist.
Right. So your question is about capacity to function, what that actually means.
Well, what it means, and how do you ask the question?
And what do you mean by that?
Well, if you said, you know, that client, those clients that I just gave that example of, yes, he can shower independently. He can shower, but someone needs to be standing there and saying, take your clothes off. We'll turn the taps on for him at an appropriate heat. He can get in. Now wash your face. Mm. Now wash your body. You know, that sort of thing. That's not independent showering.
So, Christine, how are you?
Another example of somebody who's got MSEFS. If that person showers today, that will perhaps take 2 days to recover from.
And so still needing the care?
So still needing care, or care for other things, because they're in bed for 2 days.
So, Christine, what are you telling your clients now at the moment in the wake of this?
There's a few clients that I think may have their assessments may result in being off the scheme, but it is some time ahead. It's not like tomorrow.
Exactly. It will take some time to come through.
To think it through. And I guess the other part really is that I'm not convinced that the services, the alternate services, will be there.
Indeed. These are some of the many questions, the things that we don't know among the things that we do know. Christine, thank you. Good luck with your clients and as we all navigate these changes. It's 10 minutes past 11. We will very soon be getting to our expert, who is Helen Dickinson, a Professor of Public Service Research. If you have a question, if you have a comment, like Christine as well, 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Hop on. As I say, there won't be personalised advice there, but there will be potentially a little bit of guidance, maybe some comfort, or maybe just a little bit of a different way to think about it. As I said, we'll also be talking about when is too early to start sport, and we will continue to pay tribute to James Valentine. If you haven't heard that sad news, he's died aged 64 after a full life as a musician and media personality, and after a stellar stretch, of course, on ABC Radio. We're going to speak to someone who wanted to draft him into his band, but instead Valentine joined the Models and the rest was history. That's coming up later, but next, your comments or questions about changes to the NDIS.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So, what are your questions? 1300 222 774. Already we have a couple, and here to help us is Helen Dickinson, Professor of Public Service Research at the School of Business in the University of New South Wales. Hello, Helen. How are you going?
Morning, Mary. Very well, thanks.
You've spent a busy 24 hours with your head in the books trying to figure out these changes?
It has been a little bit. I was there at the press club yesterday and then have been, trying to process it ever since.
And how would you sum up what you have seen and what you've heard, given that we don't have a lot of the granular detail about some of these details, about how some of these things are going to be carried out, which we will get to. But overall, the high shot, what's your take?
There was a lot announced yesterday, and so I think there's a lot of people trying to work out how the various different components of that are going to have an impact. Obviously, the kind of headline stuff was about the number of participants who will be taken out of the scheme and about reduction in budgets. And in response to that, I'm seeing in the community a lot of people being really scared and concerned. There's already been some reassessment processes within the NDIS and people have seen their budgets cut, and there's just a lot of fear that they're going to lose budgets, and as your caller Christine said earlier, if that's cut from their budget or if they're taken off the NDIS, then there won't be anything there to support them.
Mm. So with Christina's question, it really gets down to a very central one. How are those functionality questions posed and what would be the benchmarks?
We've got no idea, Mary, yet the detail of that isn't there. And that's because it depends on a couple of things. So one is, to make the changes around eligibility, there needs to be a change to the legislation. So the Minister talked yesterday about introducing legislation in June of this year, and then they're going to put together a technical advisory committee who will work on these sorts of questions. So they'll work on what will the tool look like and what will the threshold for the scheme be. And then the idea is that should all that go as is planned, that the changes will happen to eligibility in early 2028.
You're listening to Helen Dickinson, who's from the University of New South Wales. She's here to hear your comments or questions about the NDIS changes. 1300 222 774 is the number to call on Conversation Hour. Joan, you've called in from Northern New South Wales. What would you want to ask Helen?
Hi, Helen, thanks very much for taking my call. I've just got a few questions, if I may. Number one, we'll start with the template or the tool that you're going to use.
Are you, Joan, I'm just sort of losing you there. Is it possible to hold the phone a little closer?
I'm taking you off.
That'll be better. Thank you. Tell us your situation there.
So my situation is, I have a 46-year-old son who has a disability and he's unable to basically leave the home. It is a physical. It's functional neurological disorder plus autism plus whole range of other bits and pieces that go along with all of those things, anxiety and stuff. And he's been on a NDIS package since he was 22. So long term. So my question is, and this has always been the challenge for us because of they've always put the autism as the primary diagnosis when it's actually only part of the whole problem. The template that they're going to use to do this assessment process, number one, in the past, that template's always been very structured and rigid, and you either meet it or you don't. And the people that applied the template and the questions are usually people who've been employed by the NDIA to do the assessment process, and their training is not necessarily the best training they could possibly have, and they're not very sympathetic to the person.
Right. So
that's my first question about the template and the tools that they're going to use to assess.
Mm-hmm.
My next question is about who's going to pay for all these assessments. If they're going to have everyone assessed by 2028, ready for implementation in 30, who's going to pay for that? I mean, it already costs around about $200, $240 to get an assessment done, yeah. If not more. In fact, I think the last assessment I had to do was $600.
Did that come out of your own pocket, Joan?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Was funded by NDIS.
Okay.
And so we're supposed to get those every 2 years.
So who's going to pay?
Who's going to pay for this one? Because at the end of the day, if they're going to keep on asking for further payments, my son's on a pension, I'm on a pension, who's going to come up with this money all the time for these people?
Joan, thank you. Let me put that to Helen. So two questions there about the template and the assessment and the payment. What would you have to say to Joan?
Yeah, it's tricky, Joan, and we don't have all of that detail yet. As you know, so there's no tool available that does this sort of functional analysis at the moment in terms of eligibility. So it's something that will need to be developed. The NDIS has been working on developing something similar around planning processes that they announced yesterday actually is going to be delayed in implementation. It was supposed to be implemented from the middle of this year, but it's going to be delayed by 6 months into April of next year. And so that's a different tool that they will use around determining what somebody's functional capacity is and therefore what budget that they're entitled to. That tool is called ICAM, and it's been used previously in some disability settings and some aged care settings. But one of the challenges with that tool is that it hasn't been used for all groups of individuals. So there's going to be some changes need to be made to that so it can be used with children and so it can be used with people with very complex or communication needs.
So they're going to have to change that tool itself?
Yes, and I guess there's a question of that's designed for a planning purpose, and obviously eligibility is a different issue to planning, and so whether they will need to develop a new tool for that. And so that's something that the technical advisory committee that the minister talked about yesterday will have to look at. I personally have a bit of a concern that, you know, if the legislation passes when the government wants it to do, that still essentially only gives kind of just about a year and 3 months for that technical advisory committee to do that work, to pilot any tool to make sure that it works as it should do. Mm-hmm. And that's a really short amount of time to get that right. So in short, Joan, we don't really know what it's going to look like. We've got some indications from the assessment processes that have been taking place over last year. The other thing to say is, one of the things that really clearly came out of the independent review of the NDIS that happened a couple of years ago, one of the things that talked about was people having exactly the issue that you have, Joan, that when it comes to planning processes, that it can be really expensive to get evidence from different professionals to provide in that process. So part of the changes to the assessment were driven by a desire for people to not have to do that, so not to have those additional costs. So what they've committed to in the assessment, the planning process, is that people won't have to pay for that additional medical information. Now, some disabled people have said that they would like to take information from their medical and clinical professionals into that planning process, because they're concerned that the person who will be doing that doesn't know them.
Doesn't know them well enough. You know. Yeah.
And in a kind of 3-hour process, that's not a long time to get into that detail.
So that's
my understanding is that it will be paid for by government rather than by individuals.
So Joan won't be out of pocket for another test, in your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Understanding. There's an asterisk over everything at the moment. Of course, we understand that. I hope that helps, Joan. We're listening to Helen Dickinson, who's a professor of public service research at the University of New South Wales. It's 20 minutes past 11. Sarah, you've called from Melbourne, and you're a retired healthcare worker. Is that right? What did you want to say?
I'm also a participant, and I've had the pleasure of a couple of years of being included by Monique Ryan and Bill Shorten and the Senate committee to discuss around the NDIA. And my concerns are that haven't really been raised. There's been a lot of talk about the privatisation of and external providers, but nothing I've heard is about the actual NDIA organisation itself. So part of the legislation has always required that participants who meet the criteria is they have to provide functional reports. Now, I've gone into planning meetings and had 15 functional reports, all singing from the same song sheet, from different allied health professionals, etc. But the planners are the ones that are focusing on a diagnosis rather than the functionality. So I know a lot of people who are providing functional reports. That's how the allied health people and the people who write the reports are doing it from a functional point of view, but you're having people that are assessing you for your funding that need a diagnosis.
So what you're worried about, Sarah, is that this new functionality criteria doesn't have the backup of people who are trained or qualified to assess that?
I think that's part of it, but also with support coordination, there's no requirement for a support coordinator to have a health or a disability background.
Mm.
So anyone can set themselves up as a support coordinator.
Well, let's test that with Helen. Thank you, Sarah. What would you have to say about that, Helen? Is that addressed in these changes?
Possibly or possibly not. So one of the things the minister talked about yesterday was about doing something about third-party intermediaries in the scheme. Now, I think he might have been referring with that to plan managers. So some people, some NDIS participants can choose to engage a plan manager to help them manage their plan and spend their budget rather than managing it themselves. And there's been some reports that they're not always as very consistent in quality are as good as they could possibly be. So one of the things that the minister announced yesterday is that there will be a reduced number of organisations who will be allowed to run as third-party intermediaries. As I said, I heard that to refer to plan managers, but it might also refer to support coordinators. I'm not sure. Again, that's a piece of detail that we need there. But certainly Sarah's experience, you know, aligns with the research in the sense that people can set up around some of this stuff and they don't necessarily have to have either skills or qualification or a history in this sort of space. And the idea behind it is that this is a market, so if you're not getting the service that you want, you'll go somewhere else.
Mm.
But as we know, in a lot of places there aren't those options. There's some real gaps in terms of the markets. We've seen people face real big waiting lists. Or they might not want to kind of disappoint somebody and say, look, I don't like your service, I'm going somewhere else. So there's some real issues with how it's operating at the moment.
Well, yes. I mean, at the very least, potentially there's going to be a bit of a culture of, you know, everyone needing to be a bit more on their toes, hopefully, Helen Dickinson?
You'd hope so. I mean, one of the really big challenges with the NDIS as it is at the moment is we don't really have very much evidence or detail about outcomes of people on the scheme. So, yeah. You know, when we talk about the scheme in the media and stuff, it often gets talked about in terms of the cost, because that's basically the only kind of evidence that we've got. And so one of the things the minister talked about being concerned about yesterday was in relation to social and community participation supports.
And let's get to that. But Helen, if I can just interrupt you, we'll just go to, I do want to pick up that point because it's been raised a lot of times. I do want to get to Helen from Donnybrook, though, who's called in. Helen, your husband's on NDIS, is that right?
Yes, that's right. He is. And we've been very fortunate to have the NDIS. We really appreciate it. But one of my concerns in relation to the community engagement aspect, my husband gets out twice a week, men's shed, and without that, he doesn't have engagement with other people, and that community connection is important. And having the support worker take him means that I get 2 hours of respite twice a week so that I can then take a breath and be, you know, on the ball for supporting him when we don't have support. So I'm just wondering if respite in relation to carers is going to be taken into account when it comes to the community engagement.
Helen, that's a really good point. To the other Helen, what do you think?
Helen, it is a really, really good point. And again, I'm going to repeat myself, but we don't know the detail around this, but I would have very much the concerns that you have. I mean, to me, that's exactly the sort of stuff that the NDIS was set up to do. And it's great to hear that you get some respite there. And I would imagine that your husband really values being engaged in the community. And, you know, will derive a lot of benefits from that. He'll have folks around in the community who know him and can look out for him as well. All we kind of essentially know on this is that the minister announced that on average they're going to reduce plans by about $5,000. Now, this is an average, so it'll impact people in different sorts of ways, and that money will be taken out of the social and community participation aspect of plans. And so I think there'll be a lot of people in the same situation as you, Helen, thinking, what's that going to mean for the future of our families?
And so I guess, and thank you everybody for your calls, and we will keep on with this conversation throughout the hour. But Helen, before I let you go, I guess what would be your piece of advice for people right now who are worried?
Yeah, so I guess make your voice heard. There's a lot of really great advocacy organisations around the country that represent people with disability, and to do some of that role, they need to hear from people and hear about their concerns. As I said, there's going to be legislative change, and so when that happens, there will be a call out for people to contribute to that process to inform how they feel about those changes and what they might mean. So, you know, there's none of this is a completely done deal yet. There's a lot of detail, as we've talked about today, to nail out. And I think there's a real chance to get your voice heard within those processes. So have a think about engaging either directly in those or with advocacy organisations to make sure your stories get heard.
Raise those voices. Helen Dickinson, thank you for leaning in on this today.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Helen Dickinson, Professor of Public Service Research at the School of Business, University of New South Wales. Sorry for people whose questions on text I couldn't get to. Lots of texts coming through with lots of, you know, worries, and, you know, a lot of them can't be allayed at the moment. I guess we're all in it together. But there's a strain of this as well on text. Hi, ABC. All we're hearing from the government are all the problems and bad provider stories from the NDIS, even from Mark Butler. How about instead the ABC and media and government start talking about the amazing successes of the NDIS and how it significantly changed our lives and improves our capacity? That is one texter telling about their success story. I'm hoping that so many of us also can be reflecting on that and hoping that the good does not change even as the reforms, much needed reforms, come through.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
That is the saxophone of James Valentine with Jojo Zepp and the Falcons with Taxi Mary. That great hit, of course, because he wasn't just in the models. He was touring around with Jojo Zepp and Kate Sobrano and Absent Friends and a whole heap of people before, of course, he had his storied career on TV and then on our very own ABC radio. And we are remembering him today. We've already had lots and lots of tributes because the news of his passing has come out this morning. He's died aged 64. Joining me to talk about James Valentine is another music legend of Australia, Joe Camilleri. Joe Camilleri, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Mary. Thanks. Sad, but nice to be able to talk about James.
Yeah, what did you think when you heard the news?
I was brokenhearted, you know. I knew that he was struggling because Paul Williamson also was in the band at the time that James was in the band. I had six horn players, you know, trombones and tenors and altos. And they stayed in touch with each other. And Paul came and played with me about 6 weeks ago and said that he was in a good place. So I was really happy to hear that. And they had lunch together. And sometimes, I haven't got there yet, but I imagine you kind of get to a point where you give into it.
Mm. Yeah. Can you remember meeting him for the first time?
Yeah, I can, you know, because I was auditioning. I wanted a 13-piece band, ended up with an 11-piece band and trying. And you know, he was like a little willow. and he could play pretty good. I think he wanted to be in a jazz band more than a pop band. And I started the Char band. I had this album called Char, 1982 maybe. And we had this massive hit with Taxi Mary. And we were in Bangalore, I remember. And I'd fit them out with cummerbunds, you know, leopard skin cummerbunds.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, there must be a photo of this.
And did James like this style?
Well, he did love it, you know, because it was new for him. Mm-hmm. And he made great friends. And
what was he like on the road?
He was pretty good, you know, like he was a sweetheart. I mean, he didn't know the road. So, you know.
What did you have to teach him?
Well, I didn't have to teach him anything. I just told him, the only thing I told him to stay out of trouble. And of course, you know, and then we played together. I started the Black Sorrows a little bit later on. And I wanted James to be in the band with Paul. Paul was able to do it for a little while, but James got the call to play with the models. And then, of course, his career took off from there.
Yeah.
And was on that great song Barbados and a few other songs, and it just took off. And then the next thing I know, I'm saying, well, this guy, you know, what's the ABC doing putting him on the bloody radio?
And what did you think when he got on the radio then?
Oh, he was great, you know, like he just had a beautiful way of making people feel comfortable, and he was just a sweetheart. And you can't take that away from him, you know, whether you like the music he was playing. And he got to do what he wanted to do, you know, made a couple of jazz records. And I think I even got interviewed by him once, which I thought was really funny. I don't think he wanted to do it.
You're going to let in some of the road stories come out?
Well, you know, well, maybe not. But it was, you know, there were beautiful times.
Yeah.
Right? So we're talking early 80s. We're playing at the Piggery, Byron Bay or somewhere like that. We're playing in Bangalore. And we were nowhere, you know. I remember getting the call, right? It was a Friday night. We're playing in Bangalore. And we probably sold about 60 tickets, you know. Mm. And there was 11 of us. And we're sort of filling the room. And I get a call saying, Taxi Mary's number 8 on Countdown. And Saturday night from 80 people went to 600 people just
wow.
overnight. It was just an incredible thing that happened as soon as, because people know who's going to be on and they know what they, you know, they sort of, well, we just had the video, so we weren't playing live on the show, you know, so the word got out and boom, you know, all of a sudden the Char Band that was meant to sort of work for 6 weeks, you know, ended up, you know, a 2 year residency around Australia, and it was just a lot of fun.
And what was James like as things took off for you then? What do you remember? Are there times or moments that stick with you?
Not really. You know, like the really nice thing about James is that it doesn't matter if you're at the top of the heap or the bottom or anywhere, you know, you're just musicians.
Mm.
You're working, you're just working the boards together, and you just want to give each other, you know, the big, big love, you know, that's kind of what it's about. There's no competition between people.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the media make that out to be sort of something, but it really isn't anything. And I was so happy for him. I was a bit pissed that he didn't sort of join the Black Sorrows in the early days, you know. But
did you try to make him?
I tried to say, hey, listen, mate, you know, they've got, you know, yeah, they got one good song, you know, so something like that, you know, just trying to persuade him, you know. I think we were sort of rehearsing somewhere and he had to tell me, said, oh, Joe, you know, look, I want to do it, but I can't. I've got this offer. I said, you dirty. And, but it was just a lot. It was beautiful.
I guess what is so notable today is that James is being mourned across the spectrum in the musical world, in the media world, of course, and just so much more generally as well. Everyone talks about the wit and the joviality that he had on the radio. He just seems to be one of those blokes who was always the same.
Yeah, well, see, he wasn't. He kind of, you know, he kept his head in with me. That sort of developed over a bit more time, you know. He was so green and so ready to sort of be there and do the job that I didn't get a sense of that at the start. I got a sense of that as you know, as he grew into himself. And it's a sad day for his family and for him, and you know, and he was loved, you know, and he'll always be loved, and you know, because he was a good cat, you know, he was a beautiful human.
Yeah, and of course he went on to radio or TV at the time because he wanted to get off the road. Because you were on the road with him, I need to ask you: is there anything that drove him off the road there? What were the insights there?
I reckon, you know, hamburgers and milkshakes would get anybody off the road. It's grueling, you know, like my day today will be something. I started at 5 a.m. this morning and I probably won't finish till about 10 p.m. So they're grueling and really your physical, you pay dearly for it physically and you got to work around it. I think if you're a smart cookie like James, he found a trick in the hand. There was a, you know, there was a rabbit in a hat and he was able to sort of move away from it, but never moved away from the joy of it. And I think that's, once it's in your blood, it's in your blood. And that's how it rolls with musicians.
Indeed. Joe Camilleri, thank you so much for rolling on with us this morning in tribute.
It's a pleasure.
And there is James Valentine with Barbados. Yes, that one little hit that the models had. How funny to hear Joe Camilleri say, "Dirty dog, he should have been with Joe Joseph and the Falcons." We are remembering James Valentine today, and this on text, James Valentine, so warm and so fun. Let's celebrate that life. It is coming up to 20 minutes to 12. How young is too young for sport? How would you be if you're a mum whose toddler is obsessed with golf, sleeps with golf balls, takes them to daycare instead of stuffed toys? How would you be? Were you that sort of kid? Do you have that sort of kid? 1300 222 774. We will be talking to a mum whose kid is now at the ripe old age of 6. Now going to go compete internationally. You heard me right. I'd love to hear about your age when you started your sporting career or interests. That is coming up later this hour. But next also, we're going to be talking about the fact that more and more of us are finding it hard to get that food. What can be done?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, we all have been hearing the anecdotes, seeing it in our own lives, the struggles that people are having, making ends meet, getting food on the table. And now we've got the stats that bring up, as I say, that underline what we already know. OzHarvest is a leading food rescue organisation, and it is saying that for the first time in its history, its wait list is longer than the list of charities they can currently reach. Tell me if you know that more and more people in your life are finding it hard to access food. 1300 222 774. Just worried about putting food on the table. Joining me now is Ronnie Khan, who's the CEO of OzHarvest. Thanks for joining me, Ronnie.
Thank you so much, Mary.
So, as I said,
I was going to say the stats are very sobering.
Indeed. When it comes to Victoria, this jumped out at me. The charity seeing increased demand, 80%, and the number seeking help for the first time, 36%.
Well, Victoria is definitely the centre of Australia's food crisis. It is leading the nation with their charities completely overwhelmed by demand. And this is in our very rich and generous and abundant country. So we are seeing more need than in my 22 years of leading OzHarvest. I have never seen the need so great.
So how is OzHarvest able to respond?
Well, when you stated that fact that we have more charities on a wait list than we are delivering to, we have never seen that. So
does that mean that more charities are putting their hands up, essentially, as charities you haven't seen before?
It's charities we haven't seen before, and charities that in some way may or may not have managed have now reached the point that they absolutely need more food to feed more people, or services to feed and support more people than we've ever seen before.
And this also jumped out at me. More than 74,000 people are turned away from food support every month. That's from these charities. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yesterday I popped into a charity here in Sydney, and I have to tell you, the food was all laid out beautifully in bags. They knew that at least 150 people were coming. They were queuing around the block. They came, and then another 20 came. And those 20 people who were turned away are not 20 people. That is 20 families. That is probably 100 people. And so that's what that 74,000 per month are representing. Individuals who need help. It's confronting to go to an organization to ask for help in the first place. And then to be told, sorry, we've run out.
Indeed.
Just hideous.
And a charity's reporting that these are people who keep coming back?
Yeah, and the other very, very fascinating but scary fact and statistic is that 30% of the new people who are needing food are a new demographic. They are people who've never needed food before. They might be dual income families or single parent families who have employment. So first of all, it's families. So there are more children being affected than ever before. But this is about cost of living. We're calling it cost of surviving. If your salary doesn't cover the month, the first thing that's the easiest and only thing you can control. You can't control your electricity, your energy, your health,
Even though we try, it gets overwhelming.
Yeah, but food, we can choose to skip a meal, and that's what we're seeing.
You're listening to Ronnie Khan, who's CEO of Oz Harvest. On 774 ABC Melbourne, we're talking about an unprecedented demand for food and this food insecurity scooping up more people. Ronnie Khan, what do you believe that governments of all levels can be doing about it?
Well, I think that we have definitely got a call to action to government. First of all, they need to recognize that food relief is an essential social support alongside healthcare and housing. We need more income support raise. People's salaries are not covering the month. We need to solve the housing crisis, and we need to support children. We are calling on universal school meals. You know, Tasmania has trialed this and find they're just adding an extra 60 schools. It is fundamental if you can offer school kids a meal. We're hearing that teachers, out of their own pockets, are purchasing food to support kids coming to school without breakfast or school lunch.
I mean, definitely need those projects, the structural change. But if there's one thing that you could also suggest to any of us in our own little way, in our own little lives, what we could be doing to help?
Well, first of all, we can value food. That's the most important, because we've discovered how important it is to and what it costs to grow.
Exactly. No more food waste.
Exactly. But secondly, you know, even if you skipped a coffee a month and gave Oz Harvest $5, that could deliver 10 more meals to people in need. So whilst I know that everyone's doing it tough, of course, more dollars means we can deliver more food. But if you know people in the food industry, please tell them that if they have surplus, they should be calling us. And if you have time and want to volunteer, everywhere across the country, in Victoria, we need volunteers. So please, three things you can do: money, time, and food.
Ronnie Khan, good luck to you with all of your work.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated your sharing this message.
Thank you for joining us. That's Ronnie Khan, who's CEO of Oz Harvest. Things we can do. And you're in Paran, and you do volunteer at a local food store. Is that right?
Yes, I kind of got conned into it by a neighbour who's quite religious, and not that I am, although I was brought up that way. There's a church around the corner from where I live in South Yarra, and a girlfriend and I volunteer every month or so. And we used to offer food to anybody who held a health card, Centrelink card, whatever, and we've had to restrict postcodes now.
Oh, wow. Because of the demand.
The demand is unbelievable. We used to offer half a dozen eggs as well and some cheese. That's all stopped because we just haven't got the funds to do it. We do get some donations from local bakeries, that sort of thing. And sometimes from, you know, Oz Harvest, those sort of places.
And it must be really hard to turn people away.
Oh, it's awful, because then some of them scream at you. Mm. And, you know, I need this. I've got four children. I've got this. You know, my girlfriend and I half empty our pantries to take extra stuff.
It's
so bad, so bad. You know, and those of us that are okay, it's hard for us to understand.
Oh, Anya, thank you. Look, thank you for calling, and thank you for your work. I'm sure everybody who's listening, you know, have our hearts go out to you in that circumstance, and to everyone also who's in that situation, who's turning up. It's a big deal to turn up to some of these places and then to be turned away. Yeah, our hearts go out to you. Thank you for calling in, Anya, and for everyone who joined in that conversation. It's coming up to 10 to 12, and I am asking the question, what do you do if your baby, I mean baby, toddler, is obsessed with sport? What can you do? We're talking to a mum whose six-year-old is about to go and play golf in Canada because he started when he was two.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How young is too young for sport? 1300 222 774. Tell me about maybe you were a precocious sports kid. One that is definitely on our radar now is Albie Waden. His parents say he was 2 years old, still in nappies, when he first became obsessed with golf. His mum, Emma, is on the line to explain what she did when she was confronted with this. Hi, Emma.
Hello, lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you too. Tell me about Albie. Tell me when you started to realise, this kid's got a bit of an interest in golf.
So he was pretty young before he could really walk. He became obsessed with golf balls.
So you're just thinking he's just looking at toys, right?
Yeah,
a ball.
I was like, he's just obsessed with these golf balls. Then we went to a local driving range for my husband to have a hit himself, because my husband's a golfer, and Albie had a turn and then never stopped.
So at two, this was?
Yeah, yep. So he
had a little club.
Yep. He started off with a little Kmart, like, plastic clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And we soon picked up how obsessed he was and actually had a decent swing on him. So then my husband ordered him his own proper set of kids' golf clubs. And from there, he's now probably on his third set of golf clubs, because obviously he upgrades as he grows.
And so obsessed that he was sleeping with the golf balls, apparently?
Yep, sleeping with them, showering with them, taking them in the car, taking them to daycare. Like, literally like a bag. He would carry a bag full of 50 golf balls at one point, then he emptied them into a container, which went to like 20, but yeah, everywhere the golf balls went with him.
I've heard of kids being obsessed with birdies, but not in that way, Emma. what were you thinking at this point? Were you worried? Were you impressed? Worrying what to do with it?
I was impressed. I was impressed because, he loved it. We actually put him into some lessons. I think, he was pretty young. He must have been around two or three. And they accepted him in at that age. Normally it's age five.
Mm-hmm.
But because they'd seen him play, they were happy for him to start doing the lessons younger. So at that point I was like, this is pretty cool. There's obviously something happening here if they're happy for him to start lessons between age two and three, you know?
Exactly. You're listening to Emma Waden, who's, I guess you could say, a golf mum, even though her son is 6 years old, and we'll get to this soon, but he's going to travel internationally to play golf. My question to you, Emma, is, were you one of those parents like Andre Agassi's parents who, you know, put a tennis ball over the top of the crib? Were you, because your husband's a golfer, were you wanting this to happen? Did you will it to happen?
No. It's such a random thing. Like, it was never something that I thought, when I had kids, I'm going to push this on my kids or anything like that. I've got three kids, so Albie's the youngest. It was never a thing to think to push golf onto any of the children.
Do people think that you're pushing golf onto him?
We have had people say to us, are you forcing him to play?
Yeah, what do you tell them?
But my answer is, there's literally no way that I could force him to play, because he wants to play every single day.
So for you,
like, on his own.
So for you, it's about helping him pursue his interests.
Yeah, like, there's no forcing. He's just going out there and playing and doing what he wants to do. No different to taking the kids to go and play on the playground, you know. Like, he just wants to go and play golf, and that's what we'll take him to do.
But it's come to a different level. Tell us about this. Playing junior golf in Canada, how did that come about?
So this year's been his first year of competing. Obviously, being so young, we kind of waited till this year till we had a little bit more patience. He competed in the US Kids Golf Sunshine Coast Tour, where he came first in six and under, which was awesome. So then that qualified him for that invitation to this Canadian US Kids Tour.
You said you had to wait for him to get some patience. The mind boggles. I mean, you know, the discipline you need to have in any at any age for sport, that must be really impressive for him to have patience on a golf course. A lot of adults don't.
Yeah. So, it's pretty funny, because out of all of my three kids, he's he's very busy. He's always, like, at home, he's always on the go wanting to do something. But on that golf course, he just goes into that zone and he's like a completely different kid. He just knows. Whereas a couple of years ago, he could go out and play nine holes, but it was just the waiting time for all the kids in front of you that was too much for him.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's at that point, yeah, where he can wait.
I bet your husband's pretty happy. He's got a golf buddy right from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, but he's now a caddy, so he's lost his time of getting to play because he's being Albie's caddy.
He's Albie's caddy. Oh, that's fantastic. Yep. Does he treat him well? Does Albie treat his caddy well?
I think so, but there's probably some disagreements that I don't hear because I'm on the sideline watching.
And apparently Albie can already beat his granddad.
Yes, yep, that comes up quite often. He's quite proud of that. he quite likes, I've been and watched a couple of times and he'll turn and say to me, "Mum, watch granddad's hit."
What sort of handicap does a kid of six play off?
Oh, well, they don't really have a handicap yet as such. So he's working his way through that. But yeah, we're not at that point yet.
Emma, look, good luck with it all. I guess what will happen if he sort of starts moving away from golf? Will you be relieved or will it be a little bit of a, you know, bit of a disappointment?
We'll follow him on whatever he wants to do. Like, obviously, we're so proud of him with his little golf life. But if ever he got to one point that he wanted to do something different, obviously, we'd go with it because we're just following whatever he loves to do. And he does other sports as well as his golf, which we're happy with. But, yeah.
But not as obsessed with those other sports.
No. Golf is daily and golf's all he talks about.
Well, Emma, good luck. Good luck with being the mum of someone with such an obsession with golf, and good luck to your husband being the caddy.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That is Emma Waden. Her son is Albie. Look out for this story online at abc.net.au. Jake Kernan is the reporter of that story, and you'll see some absolutely gorgeous photos of this kid asleep in the back of a car holding his bucket of golf balls like it's his best friend. Thank you so much for joining me today on Conversation Hour.